Okay, everybody, we're going to get going. If there's anybody still outside, we'll, if you can help round them up and bring them in, that would be great. We're going to get going here. Rick, we're good?
We're good.
All right.
Five.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm going to go ahead and ring the singing bowl. We're going to do a minute of meditation or so, and I'll bring us back into session with a prayer. Mother, Father, God, we thank you for bringing us back into this wonderful place, to bring us back into this space and this time of being in retreat. We thank you for this time that we've had, and thank you for the time that will come. We recognize you as our one and only guide here this weekend. We'd ask that you would continue to guide our thoughts and our actions and our words, that we would be inspired to become better sponsors, better family members, better community members, better work partners. And we'd ask that this work that we're doing here would fill us with your love and make all of that possible. Amen. Okay, so there's a few things. How many people did the assignment and have written that? So it looks like pretty a lot of people. Most, and if you haven't done it, that's fine. If it wasn't for you, that's okay. And if you did do it and you haven't finished and you still got to get together with your partner, you don't know who your partner is, we'll try to work that out and try to get it done by the end of the evening. So one of the questions I had came up just right before we started was like, hey, what was the impetus of this? You know, like, why? What's the point of this? And the observation was that, yeah, well, was it to get everybody together with people that don't know each other in this random way? That's a part of it. I think it's really great to put people together in that way and to get this group involved so that it becomes less of a lecture. And we had this, that, and how fast did that free time go? Huh? That went pretty darn quick, didn't it? And we're going to have some more free time this evening. So that was a part of it, was just to get people together. But the bigger piece of this, in step 10 in the big book, there's a section in there and it says that every day is the day that we must carry a vision of God's will into all our day's activities. And so the big book was written in a real specific way, and it was edited in a real specific way, that they took out anywhere they could. They took out the things that you have to do it this way, you must. But here's one that they left in. They didn't say this is a suggestion. They didn't say that that when ready, they say that every day is a day when we must carry a vision of God's will into all our day's activities. So now you have something that kind of starts to be able to build on that. You've got this area of sex, security, and society, which includes your work, your family, your partnerships, your relationships, your community, all of those things. And it makes step 11... when you look at step 11, if you have that vision of what God's will is for you, then you see in step 11 where you might be falling short and say, well, here's clearly what the vision of God's will is in all my day's activities. And when I sit down at night and do my nightly review, how does that look? Is there things on there that I need to be accountable for, to seek some help with. So that's really the exercise, and the reason that I like that so much is because it gives us this vision of God's will into all our activities. I hope everybody's having a good experience here this weekend. You know, it's important to really consider what kind of experience am I having here this weekend? What's happening? Because you know, we don't know what this experience is going to be like. They've had major shifts in the history of human beings. The first one I think that they identified was the first real major shift in human beings was the discovery of fire. That was one of those things that they say is really that put our survival and our abilities and our ability to expand, and it was a major deal. And they say the invention of the wheel, and I don't know about any of these things. These are things that I've read, and this is what some people have kind of come to these types of conclusions. The wheel was a huge, big deal. That it really, when the wheel was invented and created, and you know, we're all connected, so you'll notice even in our current times that when somebody has an idea, somebody else in the other parts of the planet, people all have the same idea around the same time. This is because we're all connected. That the wheel was a big one. Then people point more modernly to the Industrial Revolution, and they said the Industrial Revolution, to mechanize production and agriculture and all of these things, was like this incredible major leap, because it kept people from, you know, each little person having to be a hunter and a gatherer and to try to, you know, work their own little piece of land, and people had some free time. You know, the Enlightenment came, and all of these things came when people had more time to create art and to become writers and to do other things and start exploring the spiritual life. The Industrial Revolution eventually, all those things eventually led to the Industrial Revolution. And then now we're living in a time where we have the latest big thing that will change things forever is happening and has happened right now, and that's the internet, this ability that we have to share language and to cross all kinds of barriers and do those things. And so then there's the fifth one that I thought about, and I think the fifth one of those is the retreat, the West Los Angeles Men's Stag Retreat at Sierra. That's one of those things that is going to go down in history like that. So we've covered a lot of ground here, but I want to back up a little bit. We touched on 10 and 11. We've touched on some of the amends stuff. And all this stuff, we could have a whole weekend and just do nothing but amends. We could do a whole weekend and do nothing but steps 10 and 11 or step 12. But I'm trying to do an overview here. This inventory that we just did, where you open up to another human being, and it's this trilogy, ourselves, God, and another human being, that we allow God to enter into that in a prayerful way. The guys I did it with, we started with a little prayer. One of the guys offered a prayer. We did our deal, and then we read our thing to each other. It was really amazing, and we shared some common experiences. And when I first wrote inventory, and I started down this trail here, I think last night, and didn't quite tie it up, but when I first wrote inventory, I was convinced that when people see how terrible I've been treated, then they're going to feel so bad about the way they've been treating me. Because I was going to this workshop, and every time I would raise my hand or open my mouth, they would say, well, that's all great, you know, but what's your experience with that? And then they would wind it back, and I'd have to finally give up and say, well, my experience was that I drank again, you know, and that's what they were going for. And okay, so that didn't work very well for you, did it? All that stuff that you know has led you to this small amount of sobriety that you're bringing to our workshop. And so I picked a guy that was the leader of that workshop to do my fifth step with, because I just knew when he saw that, he was going to be like, oh man, I can't believe I treated this guy so shabbily and shut him down so many times, and this poor guy. And of course, I got the guy, he exactly the opposite of that. I mean, he was a guy that just really rubbed my nose in it and forced me to go back and say, did you hear what you just said? You know, these things, you know, I had this resentment against my brother, who is the guy that I probably love the most on this planet, my older brother Jeff, who's not an alcoholic. But he and I were committing burglaries together, we were robbing people, we were doing all of this stuff, and we got caught, and he was like, I am not going to go to prison for the rest of my life. I'm not going to be one of these people. And he didn't just stop, you know, he did the thing that's the strangest to all of us alcoholics. He moderated. He gave up all of the drugs, and from that day, and all these years I've been sober, he's been drinking, and I've never once seen him drunk. You know, he comes to Thanksgiving, and he and his wife will bring a bottle of wine, and he'll get a little goofy once in a while, but he just was not an alcoholic. And but when my resentment was my brother Jeff, like, this is the guy that I claim to, well, tell me about, oh, I love my brother. Well, what's the resentment? Well, He got to go to college. Well, wouldn't you be happy about somebody that you love gets an opportunity like that? And I was mad because my grandfather paid and helped my brother to go to college, and he didn't do that for me. And I completely forgot about the fact that I didn't want to go to college. And my grandfather got me a job working on these fishing boats. And that turned into this amazing career that I've had. And so it was, but those were the kind of things, and it was just, and he just rubbed my nose in this stuff. And we got to my mother, and he said, you know, that simple, super simple piece of inventory, you know, my mother, first column, second column, she ruined my life, you know, nice, clean, clean, super clean piece of inventory. It affected every area of my life, has been affected by this, and then where was I to blame? Well, you know, I guess I could have done a couple things different. And then but I was with somebody that had that 10th step, that intuitive thought, that ability to make a decision, the inspiration. And if you look in that part of the book, Steps 10 and 11, the number of times that they use these kind of terms of inspiration, intuitive thought, of, you know, inspired is like the spirit within, you know, that we come to rely on this. It becomes a working part of our mind. And I would have never, ever believed that was going to be that way for me. But in fact, that's come to pass, that this is a working part of my mind. I don't get the book out at night. When I put my head on the pillow, those questions automatically start running through my head every night. And when I wake up in the morning and my eyes open, the gift of sobriety is there, unearned. Just I open my eyes and the plans for the day and the prayer come out. Before almost anything, once in a while I'll wake up and I'll panic for a few moments about that everything is going to fall apart, I'm going to lose everything, and I'll spend some time there for a few minutes, but then my mind will switch into the spiritual mode, and it's become a working part of my mind. So I was lucky to do inventory with a guy that had that experience. And so I'm reading this, didn't tell him anything. He said, looks at me, he says, how old was your mom when you were born? And I knew the answer. My mom was 19 years old when I was born. And I have a brother 18 months older than me. And she was single. We're from two different fathers. no father figure. I never met the guy that was my actual father. Never met him. I know who he was now because of, you know, all a lot of the technology they have nowadays. I know who he was, but he's gone. And so a single mom in the 1960s, I was born in 1961, and she was a singer and a songwriter, and she wrote, had a little record at one time called The Black Ball Line. Never got popular, never got radio play, but she was good enough to where somebody wanted to record her, and she would play at the coffee shops around the U District in Seattle in order to make money for us kids. And I told him that 19, and I you know, it just started working on me, like, wow, you know, here I am. I was 28, 29 years old when I was reading that inventory. And the person I want to blame all of my problems on is this 18-year-old woman who had her own problems, and she was also an alcoholic. And he said, and I just, you know, had this big list of other stuff. Well, tell me about that. And I told him about some of the bad stuff. He says, was there nothing good? Is there nothing good? And then I remembered, like, yeah, I had to think about it, and he pushed me. I says, yeah, well, we had a Christmas tree at Christmas. I remember that. Well, who do you think got that? Did you have food on the table? And I was, yeah, we were pretty poor, but there was always something. Wasn't frosted flakes. We had to do with corn flakes, and I didn't have the right kind of, but yeah, okay, I'll give you that. We had some food. Well, who do you think did that? And then I had that memory of my mom coming into our room when I was a kid, and we didn't have a TV because that was expensive in that time. Having a television was a luxury. We didn't have a TV. So my mom would sit us down at night, and she would play her guitar and sing to us. And I remembered how much I absolutely loved that. That I just absolutely loved it when my mom would play guitar and sing to us. And I would lay there, and she would be singing and singing, and the answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind, and Joan Armatrading, and all of these really beautiful folk songs, and I would fall asleep as a kid. And I think that was, I don't remember nights when she didn't do that, when she didn't come in. She'd come and sit down, and so, you know, I had that piece of inventory, and I also had, you know, I was angry about some things. There were, you know, I had the, and it's interesting. We're going to do some Ask It Basket questions to finish up this session. We got a lot here, by the way. You guys are really great on the Ask It Basket. I think for all the retreats I've done, this is the most prolific Ask It Basket we've had, because there's a lot in here. I don't know if we're going to ever get to them all, but we're going to get to as many as we can. But all of that stuff, you know, we went through it, and I had somebody that would sit there with me, and we went through the foster homes and the group homes and the stuff that had happened to me when I was on the streets. We went through the Seattle Police Department and the gym teacher in junior high school that failed me, and I was so upset. You know, he failed me, and I deserved it. But he failed me, and but he would write these things. He needs to apply himself more. He needs to exert himself more. He's not a player. He doesn't, you know. And, you know, I'm thinking in my mind, you know, I had a stepdad who was an alcoholic by that time, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm going home and getting the shit kicked out of me at night. And you're gonna write down that I'm not exerting myself. I can't sleep at night. My house is a war zone. I don't have any clean clothes to wear. I was still wetting the bed, so I smelled like urine. And on it went. And the beautiful thing about it was that, you know, he started bringing me around to this idea that you know, we could do 20 years on the psychiatrist's couch. And he told me that. And I don't think it's going to really fix this deal. You know, this was the term that I've come up for it now is like, this is the Humpty Dumpty, right? Humpty Dumpty fell off the wall. Humpty Dumpty took a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men can't put Humpty together again. And when I looked at it and we looked at what the book said that we were reborn, right? And I mean, there's things in the book. I find that's maybe a little old-fashioned statement because I had a history of when people told me that they were reborn, that was my exit signal. Like, okay, I got it. I know what's coming. I'm out of here. So when the book said it, but I don't have a better word for what we do here, that this is about getting a new life in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's about having a new outlook, a new attitude, a whole new life in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not about fixing this old life and fixing these problems. We go back and make amends for the stuff that we did and repair that damage, but the rest of this is about taking it into forgiveness. And those of you that knew Clint, you know, knew how many times that guy would bring up forgiveness and the forgiveness prayer that's in the Emmett Fox Sermon on the Mount book. You got around the year with Emmett Fox there. I thought it was a Sermon on the Mount, but this stuff, it comes through the steps, the spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. That is the result of the 12 steps. If you work the 12 steps, I've never seen it fail. I've never seen somebody go through the 12 steps and not have a spiritual awakening or this revolutionary change or this personality change, they call it in the book, this personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. That's what they say it is in the spiritual experience appendix 2 in our book. Really, it's just a personality change. It means that, and a lot of people here that are sober have had that experience already. They've had the experience of people coming up to them and saying, "Man, what's going on with you, dude? You know, you're awake. I mean, I can see it in you. What's happening?" People will say these things when they say happens long before we realize it ourselves that these things happen. And it happens as a result of the steps. But one thing for people that have been through the steps, you know, it's every one of these is unplanned. It's, you know, I can't just say I'm going to have a spiritual experience a week from Thursday and mark it on my calendar. Okay, that's it. I'm going to have a spiritual experience. And it doesn't matter how much money you buy, you've got. It's one of those things. Some people say, you know, money can't buy happiness. And there's things, Glenn and I were talking about that. There's things that say, well, actually, you know, a certain amount of money seems to, if you got enough money to put food on the table, seems to actually, some of those people are happier, report to be happier than people who don't have any food or don't have shelter and those kinds of things. There's a certain amount, but beyond that, it's not measurable. You know, people don't report much happiness when they get much more than just what's necessary. But one thing that is for sure is that you cannot buy one of these spiritual experiences. There's nobody to take your money. Cannot buy. I think they're you probably find somebody to take your money, but you're not going to have a spiritual experience. You can't buy it. You can't be clever enough for it. You can't be smart enough to trick your way into it, to find a back door in some way, or to think of your way through to have one of these experiences. Can't be crafty enough. The only way that I know that really works is to, for alcoholics, is to work these steps. I think there's probably other things, but I wanted to put that out there. I want to get to some of these questions. So we're gonna just go through. We're gonna get to as many of these as we can, and some of this has got their sticky notes. So. Okay. So, well, this is nice. I almost don't even want to read it. You demand, Kenny. What general advice can you give a newcomer for fresh or in between 3 to 6 months of sobriety working the steps? Question mark. Thank you for your service. So the first piece of advice is to say things like, you demand, Kenny. That's important. And thank you for your service. And when I'm working with a new guy, we sit down. I know I always tell people if they ask me to sponsor them, I tell them that let's meet one time. I'll meet with you one time. No strings attached. To make sure we're talking about the same thing. So that we sit down and we say, okay, we're going to meet. I'm going to expect you to show up here. And these are the times I have available. If one of those works, then we can. And when we get together, you're going to get a couple minutes to tell me about your problems and the drama in your life. And then I'm going to ring the singing bowl and we're going to be in the book the rest of the time. And we're going to work the steps, and you're going to write inventory, and are you willing to go to any lengths? All of that stuff, take care of that in the first meeting, primarily so I can use it against them later on when they say that they're... And, you know, the book backs us into a corner, doesn't it? The book absolutely, you know, when we look at we agnostics, they say, are we... Do we now believe, or are we even willing to believe, that there's a power greater than ourselves? Pretty easy terms. Do you now believe, or are you even willing to believe, that there's a power greater than yourself? Pretty simple. And just 6 pages later, it says, God is everything or God is nothing. What is your choice to be? You cannot postpone or evade, right? I mean, it's a way different deal. And so, so when I'm working with new guys, you know, that's the kind of advice I give them, that hey, man, this might back you into a corner. It might be uncomfortable, but if you're in all three sides of the triangle, you're not going to drink. You're going to be able to stay sober. You're going to be, might not feel great, but you're going to be safe and protected. So I hope that helps. Do you know if, when... you are in the presence of God, do you know when you are God conscious? God, I love that question. I love that question because, as you heard, you know, I'm a bit of a fan of Joan of Arc, and I've read a lot of great books about her life, and went back and looked at the history. I even traveled to Rouen, France, to see where this trial happened, and to read some of the stuff, which is all in French, but, you know, you find the right people, they help interpret and look at some of the books, and went to the Church of Joan of Arc. I mean, I really have been fascinated with her story, you know, how this happened, and the fact that the people were very modern, and the fact that all of this was documented, these trials, what question the attorney asked, what question that, how she answered, and one of the questions that they asked her in one of her trials was, do you know when you are in the presence of God? That was one of the questions they asked her. And they said, do you know if you are in the grace of God? Because in their belief, it was heresy to say that you were in the grace of God, because they're like, well, who are you to say you're in the grace of God? And so they were trying to trick her. She was uneducated, never went to school. They were trying to trick her. And I'd give the same answer that Joan of Arc gave. And Joan of Arc said, I don't know if I'm in the presence of God, but if I am in the presence of God, I would pray that I would stay in the presence of God. And if I'm not in the presence of God, I would pray that I enter the presence of God and the awareness of the presence of God. So she said... And so this is the sine curve, you know, for me, that there's times when I'm here and I'm just bowled over with the awareness of the presence of God, and there's times when I'm down in the lonesome valley, and, you know, they're just the same thing, you know, that they say, you have to go to the Lonesome Valley by yourself. And when you, you know, there's nobody that can go there with you, and that's where we have to go. I had to be drunk before I could be sober. So that's a really great question. Do you know when you're God conscious? And I think when I do, I'm aware of that. And if I'm tricking myself, I'm going to pray that I remain in God conscious if I can. So, what was the toughest forgiveness act you had to perform, or the one you had the most resistance towards? And can you talk about your experience walking through that? There was a couple of things, some of the things that happened to me as a kid, and it really wasn't the abuse, I was beat really bad as a young man one time, and I ended up having to have kidney surgery, and I almost died, and I had trouble with that one, you know, forgiving those guys that beat the crap out of me. And recently I had to go back to the Emmett Fox, and if I had my copy of Sermon on the Mount here right now, I'd read it to you. And somebody just took me down to the library here, which if you haven't been down and seen that little library down there, it's a pretty special place. You will walk down, you're underground, and it's the energy is fantastic. We looked for a copy of Sermon on the Mount. I didn't see one. Just recently, in a few years back, I had a business partners, and I was a minority partner in a very big business with these brothers that had been in business by themselves for 35 years, and they to get me to come into their company, and I put money in. We built a new boat, real super super big fancy boat, and borrowed a lot of money and all this, and the whole idea was we were going to build this company up and sell it. That was the idea. And if you've read A New Pair of Glasses, you know Chuck Chamberlain had a very, very similar experience, eerily similar. Because when we got to a place and we had a buyer and we were getting ready to sell the business, I had this equity in the company, and then I had these shares that would advance to be paid out as if I'd been there all those years when we sell. And they came to me and called me into their office, the brothers, and said, "You're out. You're not getting anything. We've paid you enough, and thanks for your help." And it was a lot of money, a very big sum of money that they owed me. And we went and got lawyers and went back and forth, and I finally gave up, and I just said, you know, I'll settle for what they're offering, because I just couldn't physically take the deal anymore. That one was tough. And it still comes up because I look at my bank account and I think about what my bank account would look like if that wouldn't have happened to me, and what my situation would be right now if that didn't happen and they had just paid me the money they owed me. And we had contracts and everything. But they were guys that said, "Hey, that's what lawyers are for. You know, lawyers are for breaking contracts that you don't like. You know, that's why we've got lawyers." That's the kind of guys these were. And I've written all the inventory about it, and I won't go into it too much more. But I was clearly to blame. You know, I clearly had this offer to come in. I knew these guys weren't spiritual the way that I was spiritual. I knew they didn't do business the way that I would like to have done business. And I went into business, and I spent 6.5 years with them building their company up and getting it ready and finding buyers and doing everything. It just was a really bad situation. But I knew it going into it. I knew it. And there was just a part of me that thought I always wanted to be a boat owner. I'd worked for all these owners and ran companies and been general managers. And they said, you know, I told them, "I'm not coming to work here unless I'm the president and CEO of the company. That's the only job I haven't had in business. You know, I've had every other." So they said, "Oh, no, you're president, you're CEO." They gave me the title, they gave me the money, and I had, you know, a lot. So I just got swept away with these guys. And that one has been so hard. But what Fox says in his deal is you read his deal and you put the name in that I forgive these guys now. I forgive their transgressions. I forgive the... Yeah. It says the method of forgiveness is just this. Get by yourself. Repeat a prayer treatment. I won't read this whole thing, but it says, as far as I am concerned, it is finished forever. I cast the burden of resentment upon the Christ within me. He is free now and I am free. I wish him well in every phase of his life. This incident is finished. The Christ has set us both free. I thank God. And then get up and go about your business, he says. So you say the prayer, and there's much more to it than that. So thank you very much for bringing that up, Eric, and I appreciate that. The what it goes on to say is once you've forgiven somebody, that's it. Fox was what I call an absolutist. That is absolutely it. When you've done that, you're done. You don't go back and say, "Well, I'm gonna do the forgiveness prayer over." You never do it again. But when it comes up, then you just remind yourself, "Oh, when that comes up for me now, I say, oh, I forgave that person. I did that prayer. I said those words. I committed to that. I forgave that person. It's none of my business anymore. I'm just digging up this old resentment." So I hope that people will use that because it's been so useful to me, and I use it with the guys I sponsor when they have some deal that's really, really troubling them like that. How does being in recovery help or not your personal relationships? And the personal relationships, it's funny, I just got to say this. So to sit here and pull baskets out, I like doing it. I like the idea of it. I think it helps to kind of bring the group in and find out what people are interested in really talking about. And people can come to a retreat like this and get answers back to some of their questions or partial answers. But I want you to take everything I say with a grain of salt, as they say. Because one of the experiences that I had when I wrote Inventory was I realized that I'd been wrong about everything in my entire life. And I mean everything. I wasn't just out, 90 degrees, 100 degrees. I was out 180. I mean, I was wrong about the Seattle Police Department. I was wrong about the Republicans. I was wrong about the Democrats. I was wrong about my brother, my sister. I was wrong about that seventh grade gym teacher. I was wrong about my grandfather. I was wrong about my grandmother. I was wrong about my neighbors. I was wrong about, there was nothing. I mean, it was like complete psychic change needed here, right? That I was wrong about everything. So when I get asked these questions and I give these answers, just remember you're getting answers from a guy who admittedly has been wrong about everything in his entire life. So obviously this recovery in my personal relationships, I've learned to be kind and considerate to people. I've learned to listen to people and to react. And one of the things that I do with everybody, business or when I'm listening and thinking, the thought that I come up with is, what is the kindest thing I could say right now? That's what I do in my personal relationships with people that have no idea about AA, don't know anything about the spiritual life or what I'm doing. I think, what is the kindest thing I could say right now? And it's just amazing how it works and changes people's view of things. And when you say something like that, I was just at an embarrassing number of baseball games up in Seattle, and I'm a real Seattle Mariners fan, which has been very tough because up until last year they had 21 years of losing seasons in a row, and I sat through all of them and went to lots of games. So, there's a kid that sits next to me at the game, and his mom is there with a lot. They've got season tickets, and they sit right next to us, so I see him a lot. And my deal, I always buy Cracker Jacks, a big bag of Cracker Jacks, bring it into the game, and then I share them with this kid. And he's kind of out of control. He's got some, I suspect he's got some learning disabilities or something. He's homeschooled. His mom, and it's not because they're granola kind of homeschool people. I think it's because, I really think it's because he doesn't fit in a public school or even a private school very well. He's a little different, this kid. But I just love him, and I share my Cracker Jacks, and we share things together. And I was telling him about that. I was saying, because he says some things, and his mom gets mad at him. And I say, you know what I do? And I told him about it. I said, you know what I do? I always think to myself, I play this little game, and I think when somebody's doing something, I always think, what is the kindest thing that I could say? And he thinks about it for a minute, and he looks at me, and he said, I love sharing Cracker Jacks with you. This is the kindest thing he could come up with. So it has a huge difference. I mean, I think so many people would vouch for that. Being in AA makes all the difference in the world. And it's easy. Like, how many times have you spotted somebody out in public and you just start talking with them and you think, AA, 12-step, yeah, this guy is, that's what's going on with this guy. And you ask them something, you drop something, and they say, oh, yeah, I'm a friend of Bill's, yeah. So, okay. How do you do step 10 in your life presently in the past? And I'd say I do it, you know, real similar, but this exercise that we just did is how I do 10th step. You know, I do my 10th step by trying to continually look at what is the vision of God's will in all my activities and take inventory on that. Each day, take inventory, do the 12 and 12 talks about spot check inventories and some other things, but that's how I do it. If I'm dealing with resentment, I put it on paper. If I have a fear buildup or I have some piece of sex inventory to write, then I'll write the inventory. I mean, as I said before, you know, I don't think it's an overstatement. You know, I really am a some people would say, well, Kenny's way too deep in the AA hole. That might be how they would put it. But I'm a AA devotee. So I do the 10th step just like it tells us in the book. Would you rather be loved or happy? Clint Hodges. That was a great. I don't know who gave that to us, but that's great. That was a Clint quote, I think. Yeah. Would you rather be loved or happy? Yeah. Beautiful. Who put this in? Somebody must have. All right, man. Thank you very much for that. That is quite a bright spot. And of course, you know, even just coming into these retreats, the thing I want the most is I want you, you know, I come into these retreats and I just want you to accept me and to love me. And I'm so worried about what you think of me. I'm just so concerned about what it is that, what are people going to think? Are they going to think, is this guy qualified to be doing a retreat? What's his deal? Who is this Kenny from Seattle? What's he doing? You know, those things still, all these years, they go through my mind. And it can be a really dangerous path to go down. So, to go down that need for your attention and love in all of these areas, it's never, ever, ever enough. There's never enough of it. And, I hope that you'll be encouraged here to go listen to some of these people. If you didn't get to know them, or even if you did, go back and listen to them. We'll do a couple more questions. This is a poem, anonymous poem. My Creator, thanks for these few moments resting in the palm of your hand. Soon I will return to your blessed world, your brave and joyful child. Anonymous. That's beautiful. I'm going to read that one more time. My Creator, thanks for these few moments resting in the palm of your hand. Soon I will return to your blessed world, your brave and joyful child. And we're going to do some work on the return part tomorrow. And so I love that, that one of the things I haven't talked about this weekend, and we'll spend a couple minutes talking about this, and then we'll close, let people get to dinner. And just for everybody's information, just so I don't forget when we tie this up, that after dinner, there's a meeting that'll start in this room, right? It's an open AA meeting. I don't know who's going to be leading it, but it's not going to be me. And we're going to have an open AA meeting, and I think the format is going to be the West Los Angeles Men's Stag group format meeting, and we'll be led, and people will, so we'll look forward to that. It starts at 7 o'clock. And we'll do that meeting, and then we're going to have some free time and some fellowship and stuff after that. So one of the things that a guy gave me, and this is a guy that's not in AA anymore. He went off and did Scientology. As far as I know, he's still doing well in his Scientology. And he came down here to Los Angeles. He actually was from here, moved to Seattle, and then got into the Scientology deal, came back down here to LA, where that's actually a thing, I guess. And I shouldn't have said that. That was critical. But I can't help it. Sometimes saying stuff like that, it's not right, but it is so fun. It's so fun. But the piece of advice, he said, Kenny, I was doing some work with him, and he said, he knew I knew so much about the big book, all, you know, this intellectual knowledge. Oh, yeah, this page and that page and this I can quote. And he said, Kenny, I want you to go back and reread the book as if it was poetry. And when I did that, I found those things that Bill wrote, and he was absolutely amazing at the poetic pace and styling and writing that he did. This, you know, that the great fact is just this and nothing less. We've been, we've had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our entire attitude and outlook on life. That he wrote about the awful awakening to the four hideous horsemen: terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair. When he wrote that stuff, you know, the quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I'd met my master. These things, there's just this poetic style. My daughter is a poet, and her husband is a poet, and they both attended the same high school. They're still together. They both attended the same college. They went to the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, which is a liberal arts school, very liberal, no grades, but it was a school I was actually very impressed with, really impressed, and I was against it when I was wrong. Another thing I was wrong about was the kind of education that you would get going to Evergreen. But as near as I can tell, she got a degree in anarchy. That's the best I can tell. So reading their poetry, both of them, became, and you know, the reason they say read the big book by as like it's poetry, and why that stuck with me is that if you read poetry with your intellect, it's as if it's a foreign language. Especially the masters, these great poets, when you read their stuff and you look at it and you think, how did that person, you know, ever connect these words in that way in order? But if you read it from here, it's like, I have no idea what this guy's talking about. But if you read it from here, the heart, it's a whole different experience. And that's the way we look at the big book. You know, the big book has to be read from the heart. And that's why it's such an amazing experience to sit down with another person and go through the book in that way, with that person sharing their experience, not their knowledge, but their experience on what it was like for them when they did that part of the book. And when I was doing that, one of the things we used to do, we used to look up words in the dictionary. If there was words that I didn't know, they would say, we were going to make sure that we're going to read one paragraph, and we're going to make sure you absolutely understand what that paragraph is about, and we're going to make you tell me what your experience with that is. What does that mean to you from the heart, not from here? And so we'd read the paragraph, and if there was a word there I didn't understand, we'd look it up in the dictionary, and we had a dictionary guy. And I didn't know what altruism meant. Honestly, when I got to the program, I had no idea what altruism was. I had no idea about this impersonal goodwill towards all human beings. Impersonal means like, I don't care. I'm gonna love you, and there's nothing that you can do about that. I'm gonna love you, and there's nothing you can give me in return. It's just this impersonal, that altruism, and the real definition, I think, is from the heart. In AA, they say it's for fun and for free. That's how we describe it in Alcoholics Anonymous. We do it for fun and for free, altruism. So I didn't know what that meant when they said this altruistic way of life, and so they looked it up for me. But nobody had to look up the word terror for me. Nobody had to look up frustration or despair. I didn't ask him, well, can you get the dictionary out for that one? Because it was here. And that's the way we do it. So I think we're about out of time here for dinner, so we're going to close up. We're going to come back. We're going to have an open AA meeting. I'm going to encourage everybody to stick around tomorrow, because we're going to do some really cool stuff in the morning with our morning sessions. And I'm going to be around, you know, until late. So if you got questions and stuff, just feel free to pull me aside. I put my name and number and email address on a piece of big paper over there, so you can go write it down or take a picture. I did have it up here for a little bit, but I needed to pull it off, and it came off. So I put it over there. And I mean it. I want to stay in touch with people. I do so many of these retreats, and it's very few people that I really get calls and stuff from, and I'm not such a busy guy that I can't take calls. So please make use of that number, and you know how to get a hold of me. So thank you. I love you guys.